number one. If you are born, sooner or later you die. Fact number two. In order to capitalize on the space of time between birth and death, each individual should grow in a vital, creative way. Each must live his inner, personal, sensitive life. That's a quote from an article that Save gave me just before supper. A Place for True Ideas, Our Theater by Paul Baker. It is rather a difficult task to try and define what is meant by creativity or the creative life. But creativity seems to be an innate part of man and has been represented throughout all ages. As far as art goes, from the Lasso cave paintings 20,000 years BC. Now, I'm not sure about this next statement, but it represents a quest and or a recognition of an ideal truth. It's a misconception to think that there are people and then there are artists. God created the world, and man was created in God's image. So creativity has been a part of man from the beginning of time. Every person is creative in his own way. It need not be painting, ceramics, printmaking, or sculpturing. We all think creatively, and this thought demands more than visual imagination. It can be an activity which gives you a chance to have an inner experience and to grow in the execution of the job. Gardening, designing, dresses, cooking, building, cleaning a room, writing a play, painting a picture, or developing a new concept in science. It is the point of view, the approach, which makes the difference. Very few people ever learn that the positive, creative growth is the essence of life which separates humans from animals. The artist tries to portray or represent or interpret this creative thought in a visual manner. Creative growth takes guts and great energy. It requires a continuous struggle. It reflects a philosophy built on do, not don't. Creative growth often leads each of us into making unhappy, sometimes disastrous mistakes. From time to time, we will look foolish and awkward. We will be criticized and ridiculed. The dull ones, the almost dead ones, will say ugly things about an alive, growing person and his untried products. But making mistakes, fearless of the consequences, is the first prerequisite for growth. But do not think of creative growth as a large, shattering experience. Creative growth is very personal, extremely fragile at first. It starts with getting acquainted with yourself. It is your inner spiritual life. It is probably that individual quality which does not fit precisely anywhere in society. It quite possibly can grow from a daydream, a daydream which begets action, an idea which takes some form. It is the timid, hazy formation of a new vision of yourself.
That leads very well into the first thing that I want to talk about, and that's something which I think is closely related to our image of ourselves. We are all, in one sense or another, object-oriented people. We surround ourselves with a great many objects. We like to have things which may be useful to us. They may be purely enjoyable. They may just, in one way or another, enrich our lives. Now, there are a couple of observations I've made that have been interesting to me. One of them is an example of the homes that people choose to live in. in a certain area south of San Francisco known as Daly City, I saw some interesting things happening lately, which I'm sure many of you have also seen or have heard about. I used to drive up to San Francisco fairly regularly to work. And when I went through this area, I found that one day a beautiful hillside was being bulldozed off. All the irregularities were being shaved away. The trees were scraped off. And the natural roll of the land was being changed drastically. A couple of days later, I may drive by and find that this newly scraped land has been made into terraces. There are regular steps all across the hill. A couple of days later, I may drive by the same place and find that cement was poured on each one of these terraces. A few days later, there were vertical poles, and then on and on, day after day, something had changed, and it had changed the same way for every single unit, which eventually became a home. And before long, people were crowding in to buy homes in this place. These are not homes that people are buying because they're cheap, they're mass-produced, they can't afford anything else. They're homes which people are buying with a large amount of money many times. And I wondered many times in looking at them, what is it that those people think of themselves, and what do they learn about themselves living in homes like this? How is it that people can maintain any sense of being unique individuals when this is what they choose to surround themselves with? Another example is something which I've heard, which I think is rather interesting. In the larger cities of our country, there's now a very, very fine service available for young people who are about to get married. This service is provided by large department stores, and it goes this way. The bride goes into the department store, finds the consultant, and makes some relatively simple decision about how she will furnish her home. It may be maybe as simple as picking a color or a color scheme, maybe making a decision about china, maybe perhaps even some information about the income class that she's in, right? And the result of this is that a computer provides a full plan for how she can correctly furnish her home. This is, I'm sure, very comforting to many people. You have the security of knowing that what you have decided upon is right. It's correct because a computer has decided it, and after all, computers are able to handle information that people don't process quite as well. But I say this not at all because I have any gripes about computers. I work with them and I think they're just fine. But one thing about computers is that you've met one and you've sort of met them all. And people aren't like that. Something has happened, I think, in a fairly recent time, and I don't think it's entirely the fault of the computer, but it seems to run parallel with the development of the computer. And that's that people seem to forget that they are unique individuals. There's a lot in our lives that can make us think that we are not unique. We become numbers to a computer, and we begin to see ourselves as another computer-like machine. perhaps an inferior computer because we don't process information as well. I very strongly believe that the objects that we surround ourselves with are an expression of what we think of ourselves. And I believe that an individual who believes that he is unique needs to be creative not only in what he makes, but in what he chooses to surround himself with. So this, in a sense, this places an obligation on us to look at objects and to decide what it is that they mean to us. Now, certainly we'll do this more with the things that we choose purely for aesthetic reasons, the art objects that we have in our homes and so on. But I think also it's important in the things that we choose to serve our needs. And this isn't always, you know, very practical or very possible, but I think ideally that this is the situation that I'd like to be in, that the things that I use ought to be pleasing and ought to have some kind of meaning for me. So it becomes important then to avoid a temptation to choose things simply because we know that people have decided that they are good things. I'm sure that we've all seen reproductions of pictures which can be seen in thousands and thousands and thousands of homes. And sometimes there's a temptation to choose these reproductions because we know that people have decided they're good. I think this is to be avoided. Now, as a point of departure from that, I'd just like to say a little bit about ceramics specifically and a little bit about the value of creating something, for instance, in ceramics. It's been very, very interesting to me to see how cautious people are in approaching an art or a craft. Many, many people will come very apologetically and say, "I'm not artistic." Or, as one very small girl said to me the other day, "I can't make anything." And this girl and many others have found that, lo and behold, they can make something, and it's a very exciting thing. I think that, in a way, clay is of special value in this line, because clay has no value of its own. It's one of the most common materials in the world. And it's only by putting something of yourself into it that you can give it value. I think that's that means a lot to people. I look at it from the standpoint of one who uses this medium as a hobby, and it's strictly a pleasure for me to be involved in something like this. And I think it in a sense develops in yourself a feeling of uniqueness too. Make something and to feel that you can create something that's pleasing.
Yeah. Helen told you, you have a way of showing your creativity and just your exercise of your own individuality or free will and choosing objects that are around you. And then as we move into the art field, and I'm being particularly a little more painting and talking about artists and judging them, I wanted to say that when it comes to the communication of a piece of art, there is a lot of it that falls on you also. We often hear people criticizing artists that you didn't communicate with them, maybe there's some that don't, but to communicate, there has to be some openness on your part and some response too. It's sort of a two-way thing. And we shouldn't limit ourselves. I think the reason a lot of people don't communicate in this field, they don't open themselves up. They walk up to a thing, if I knew something about it, I could understand it, or says nothing, walk out, and don't really try to look and study, and we often say, let it speak to us, which letting the painting interact with you. I've seen people receive things from paintings that had absolutely no formal education or anything, but could react to color and design, reacted spontaneously, and that this is a charge to you. The reason I mention this is once in a while, too, we take one segment of art, and then we limit ourselves to that, and we just have nothing to do, or we'll completely disregard all and start going into something good and bad, or I know what I like, and so on. And I'd like to just ask you tonight to remain open, too, because man is a many-sided many-sided individual. He has this freedom of free choice, just as you do in selecting your art objects. We'll move on to the artist now and how he works. As an individual, man is made up of many different sides. Many of these sides are in one person, or you tend to be a little more one way than another. You're a little different from your friend for many different reasons. One person expresses themselves in short statements. Another person takes forever to explain the same thing. Another person, just everything is very romantic and romanticizes on everything. Another person is just cut and dried and intellectual. And it's this way in the art world, too. The art world is just saying things or expressing themselves. There are people that express themselves in visual or plastic terms, just as another person finds their expression more in the written word or more in song or more in... they find their way of expressing it in a visual way. So you have artists who, some that are dealing purely in a very intellectual world, and everything is very almost mathematical and very rigid rules, or very precisely thought out. This is one type of individual, one type of art. And this type of art has been going on at all times. Once in a while, the age they live in influences them enough. So you get the individual exercising his own personality, free will, and then another facet, which maybe I'm leaping ahead on, but you also then get influences of where he's lived, the age he lives in. That's why we have art varying throughout the ages, the individual plus the interaction of his age. Then you may have this romantic person who doesn't go by these rigid intellectual rules, these cultural rules, but he's a very expressive person, and he uses color expressively, and everything is sort of an emotional type of statement or response. And this is his contribution, and he makes his statement in the painting or whatever visual artist finds, and he has to transfer this expression into this flat surface. You can't ply it, and this is either, I suppose, sculpture, pottery, or any other fields. In the painting field, you're stuck with this flat surface, except for a few experiments such as of collage or sticking things on a canvas to bring it out to a slight degree, but it's basically a flat surface. And how are you going to get these colors to work around and help make your statement? Many things that look like they're a very must have been very extemporaneous, very spontaneous. This is this artist's way of expressing, but they might have been very carefully calculated, but calculated on a different basis than the very intellectual one. Then there's a person, just as in poetry and in our everyday life, there's the people that live in their dreams. And so, too, there are artists that are in this dream world, and this is their way of working. And the art world doesn't analyze them or condemn them or say one should exist, one shouldn't exist. There seems to be room for all, but this will take another bent off in another direction. It may be completely different. You can't lump them together at all. They'll work in a completely different way. Then you have people that dream world, I guess, is related to fantasy world. You know, in poetry, there's fantasy poetry. And you probably know some friends that you wonder if they've come down to earth. But he has this wonderful, and this is a realm of man that the psychologist is still peering into. There are really realms of art that probe into worlds that are yet undiscovered, that we're still probing. And the artist is working in these worlds too, and maybe something that he's been able to state in our terms, he's arriving at the same time as someone in a scientific world. So we have someone who's working in a more psychological, consciously psychological vein, is different from the fantasy where a world person really lives in fantasy. You also might have, mentioned a person as both the romantic is really lyrical, to come close together, but still it's another fate. This is your own individual expression. Then through the ages, as the age they lived in dawned on them or worked on these individuals, you have these influences, or where you live at the present time may work on them too. But so through the ages you have things like artists who are making statements within this realm that they work in. You have parallels sometimes with other discoveries. The impressionists that existed in the last century were actually working out the science of light that the scientists were working out on. And the discovery of the prism and the breakup of light on the canvas occurred at similar times, so that you have, and I'm sure music people can probably parallel this too, things going on in different worlds expressing similar ideas. You can trace back Fra Angelico in the time leading to the Renaissance, was intellectually stating the statements and the ideas of St. Thomas Aquinas. You get things like this. And then you get artists that completely pop out of their own area. You know, El Greco will pass some things around here. 14th century Spanish, seems to be contemporary today. He's what we call a universal artist, but new, it's just transcended his time. And these are maybe the ones that have the quality of greatness, if we want to say there is a comparison. Art can be an idea, it can be a statement, it can be working out a real problem of the age, or it can be a very personal thing. It's not related to anything else that this person is trying to tell. It might be just this person's pure reaction to the universe or ideas, his pure joy of living, or his despair, or his protest. And this is his way of making the statement. We find, and now looking to many artists working, looking to see if there is a relationship between man and his universe. And some artists come close to this. Do you like it? I'll get into her. We have artists that we can read into and single out for some of these poems. I think we all know Van Gogh, and I have one of his reproductions here, The Starry Night. I'm sure most of you are familiar with this by now. And he came to this in 1889, and a lot of people think of him as a contemporary artist. Well, he's hardly one of our contemporaries, and he died the next year in 1890. And many people that are still, seem to be hard for people to understand, are not just young upstarts, but are older men. Picasso's still living in his 80s. Braque just died several years ago, and these men are still, their ideas are still so far ahead of things and close, or their ideas are still to be assimilated, it seems, among our everyday living and our ideas. Can I bring in we're going to say, make a statement about, in quotes, religious art, as other people have been stating in some of their lectures, that God works through many mediums, and there really is no so-called religious art. There might be art that has a content which we equate to our religious stories and do a fine job expressing those, but you find expressions of man's relationship with his environment, with his universe, that have deeply religious tones that are done by artists that maybe verbally had no direct intention. And again, it's what the work has brought out. This particular work, I just want to mention this now, was mentioned. Paul Tillich in 1945 in the World Council of Churches met in Chicago, had the Art Institute put out a little booklet, and he made statements with about 10 pieces of art that he called, went out on a limb and said he thought these were the religious art of the time. And one was Van Gogh's Starry Night, because he felt it showed a real intensity and oneness with man and his universe. And another one, which you don't have an illustration to, but just mentioned and it may mean something to you, is Picasso's Guernica. Of course, Picasso isn't known for his church life at all. And his Guernica is a very distorted, black and white, large mural of a reaction to the Civil War in Spain. And he felt that it showed man's compassion and resistance and reaction to war and destruction. And he felt that this was a religious, was reaching a level of religious thinking. I just want to point out to you
that I think this really represents representative of Van Gogh's vitality. This painting never stops, it just keeps moving.
Yeah. Now you call him an expressionist if you wanted to label, permitted to label one of these artists the way it goes. I would pass this around with it. I don't know if Van Gogh did this Good Samaritan, and I'm sure he never saw it in his Sunday school book. Even though these paintings have been available for, almost 80 years. Just from the point of view of individual differences, I want to show you, of course, not some of these people are from different ages, so this would be the age of I found reproductions that do show some contrast. Now this one is called An Imaginary Landscape. So the landscape was not even a real one that he was naturalistically trying to represent, but it's one that was made up of imagination, but has a naturalistic look. And then this is Paul Cézanne, who's taken the landscape, used his creative source to reconstruct, rethink the forms and volumes. And I think the two make a great contrast of what an individual has put in. These, I just found about 3-4 crucifixions. And of course, this is a very, very early one from the early Byzantine church. If you want to find some very distinctive, you want to find a really another look of Christ, go back to the very early church where they did very strong, very simple things. All they wanted to say was to make the statement of the figure, the crucifixion, what the event was, and they kind of let it go at that. And it always came out very strong. Then this one comes from the Renaissance, where rebirth of learning. We've gone back to the Greek tradition. We've revived a lot of knowledge of man and build on it, the love of the human body, and getting to really what is often thought of the high point religious art quotes, and it was really a very man-oriented society and time. And what they were interested in was in portraying the body in various poses and perspectives and marvelous technique. And then this is Albrecht, I should change my time, but it gives you another expression, so you see the various things. This is this face of Christ. If you really look back through art history and you start to compare several artists, you'd see that no two artists gave Christ the same expression or the same face. And there were a lot of artists that gave strength to his appearance and represented him in many ways. So, I didn't need to say more on that. I didn't find very many Madonnas, but these are two early ones. Here's an example of this very early church, where you've got this old Madonna, and you can trace the whole history of our thinking on religion theologically, or our thinking on the Madonna and child scene. The early Madonna staring out, trying to give her an ethereal look. Baby over here, just balancing on her hand. They're both staring out. Usually Christ is blessing the world already, giving the motion sign. But this to them was documenting the nativity. They weren't trying to show Mary as a human being. Mary was a divine figure that her staring out with this unruly gaze, her sort of belonging to the other world. And then as the gospel moved along and was established, we had her in the time of the Renaissance being elevated to her queenhood, and she wore royal robes, and she sat in castles, and she sat on landscapes, and she wore the most marvelous velvets and jewels. Part of this was the artistic imagination having fun too with the painting. And then as the Reformation approached and the coming, you can just see the coming of the social gospel, you see Mary becoming a mother and loving this baby. And she becomes more and more the mother image. You can almost trace the whole gospel interpretation through that. There are several here on.
It's kind of interesting to note the difference. Portrayals of the Nativity in the different schools, like the Flemish artists portrayed Christ, the Christ child, as being very skinny, and he was usually lying on a pavement, a stone pavement or something. And the Italian artists portrayed him as being fat, fat little baby, giving the sign.
Sometimes he was up walking around.
Yeah.
John the Baptist was often his older brother, and once they were really quite close in age. There's just lots of liberty. Well, we got off on a tangent here, but I think this is Al Greco that did the other crucifixion, too, and he has this wonderful Garden of Gethsemane, which I've finally seen in reproductions and coming through some of the Augsburg and some of the places. But there have been these interpretations through history that have been marvelous resource material. But the early church didn't care what the artist's background was or what his religious beliefs were. They were the great patrons of art. They hired the best. And they just said, you come in here and here's what religion means. Of course, there only was one statement at that time. There wasn't too much conflict, or it didn't allow them to get into conflicting ideas. So they could pretty well follow the rules and follow the patronage. And their individual expression was the way they created out. Are you ready to jump off not knowing what we've all said?
Yeah, I don't have to answer what you said. I mean, for point, I mean, you're...
Well, we told about the different individual directions an artist could take because of the many sides of man, and then the different ages that kind of cut off from that now, too. And now the educator can take more of the values and standards for the consistency. So we have a pickup of art.
I had a quote I was going to say some time ago. I'm a nerd. I just have done a few stitches. I can't find the exact quote, but the thing I would like to say particularly is that within the canvas you have a reality. The artist is using his intellectual sensitivity to create something. He's not trying to make something just like he sees or anything of the sort. It's impossible for him to do that anyway, to reproduce what is outside. He's recreating it, he's taking it through himself. And whether he is being naturalistic so that you can recognize a tree as a tree, or whether he's being non-objective, he's using all of his sensitivities to create a reality. I guess I don't have all the things I thought I did. I thought I had a pile of them on the Mondrian prints. But the, okay, then I'll just, just ad-lib your time. To get across what he wants to get across, he's dealing with three things primarily: with color, with line, and with form. And all of these things compose whatever you have. Like here you have a lot of your lot of squares in a town. Put together, he's used a structural geometric themes, and what's so amazing about Mondrian, Mondrian there, is that he started out as what you might call a naturalist in his painting. Really did look like a barn with a stream going front, but he, even in the earlier painting, you could see how he was looking at these things in a particular way. He was eking out from his vision certain aspects of the vision. He was looking toward the form behind what you saw. And finally, he goes into this, where he's gone completely structural. But he didn't just sit down and do a bunch of little boxes without thinking about them. And this is the point I'd like to make about abstract art, too, is that abstract art does take two forms. One of them is a spontaneous abstract art, like Jackson Pollock tried when he was flipping paint against canvas. He was doing that to see what just accidents, what they could do, and I think he was trying to break away from some of the rules we have. I mean, if you get too many rules in art, then we might as well have a computer do it. You have to be able to break a few rules. But in the other kind of abstract art, which is really, I guess, what I do and shows in this painting over here in the corner, is that I very definitely am working with something visual. I'm stimulated by something I see, whether it's a human figure or whether it's mountains or a flower. But reconstructing my vision, choosing particular colors to work in a certain way for me, choosing major shapes to work in a certain way, and bringing these together into a theme that will represent something, not a particular mountain, but a more abstract idea of space relationships that show up through color and through direction. Did you read the creative poem? Okay, good. I have found a poem in this book that I think sort of says, leaves open all kinds of possibilities for art. I mean, art, you can't label it. You can't say art has got to be a certain thing because it's open-ended. The artist is creating something and he's always inventing new ways. And creation is something new. He's looking for new modes of expression. And each artist is different. And, I'll just say what she said. This is Sister Creta. Art is the work of a person, a human being, who is free to take into himself what he sees outside, and from his free center put his human stamp on it. The artist is resigned to the whole world, that reality or the world is shaped by man and not the other way around. Yeah, I see my painting. I'm going to see there's yours.
I put the watercolors over here.
Yeah.
They're saying that, so you should judge good or bad. We're not discussing that at all. It's only artist as an individual, at least out like Katie and I as individuals actually should be different, and finally you work a different approach.
But we don't think one of us is right or wrong. There's one way that, you know, I see it a certain way, and Betty sees it a certain way. And I don't think she's wrong for seeing her way.
Well, I don't see the way I do either, but it seems to go that way.
Anyway, this painting, we brought her paint down. I don't feel mine is done by a long shot, but I didn't even explain to you how it happened. I was kind of dull for an idea, wondered what to do. Stretched the canvas and sat it down on the coffee bench where we have coffee against the tree, and the shadow from the tree went right on it, just about the way it is. So there's another way, instead of just sitting there looking at it, getting visual images or gone further. I actually quickly took out a pen and kind of sketched things on, but I said when I get back to my room, I know I'll wonder what all these little lines are about. So then when I got back, and it was all just a muted shadow, sort of black and white, there was no color transfer. The color is all mine, the interpretation of it. So I guess if you had to label it, it'd be sort of expressionist. No, we did put our watercolors there. Both he and I could hire us, and I think you'll see the different techniques there too, where hers are structured and sort of broken up. I don't know, I understand. Anyway, I guess coming to the mountains too, I'm trying to use lots of color and use color expressively and not naturalistically. We're trying to move away from it anyway, some of it. I mean, I've got some green trees and so on, but I'm not the person seeing more than a complete trip of the mountains. Whereas seeing Katie sees more of the real structure and the form of the structure of the mountain. Yeah,
I'm sort of aware when I came here, I'm building something, you know, that I visually recognize into the different planes of different shapes and sizes, planes that go vertically and horizontally, and also planes that move backwards so that these different levels of vision and things get dimension. And you can achieve this effect through the direction of your mind and also through the intensity of your color. So your color plays in when the colors are going bright. They quite often are in the forefront as you're slowing down in these steps. You can get visual things by the color. And something else too. You're not really going so far away from nature when you put a lot of colors into it, like into the mountains, because they really aren't gray.
And who can say what color they are? Depends on when you look at it, really.
Yeah.
And it's changing constantly. It's changing while you're looking at.
Yeah.
And who can say which line you took or what color you took or?
Yeah, and that's where nature is so. I like working with it. I receive all the kinds of ideas from it because, it speaks out. It has all these tones and colors and rocks are just fantastic. These mountain rocks, you just have to look at them. It's like Leah was talking about birds, and we don't hear the birds unless we listen for them. And it's almost that way with color, with the subtle colors. I mean, you know, if you see a bright pop, you notice it, but the subtle colors in the rocks, you have to look for them.
Where she sees the structure I'm mentioning, and I see the mountains as full of rhythmic lines, the sweepingness of the valleys, and the constant lines that move through it where trees follow canyons. And I seem to see it more on these big sweeps rather than the breaking the blocky shapes. I think Terry was going to talk about sculpture cleaning.
I was just going to say that, or Katie was talking about abstract art. And it seems that quite a few, if not most artists, throughout the course of their career, begin to abstract. They start out fairly realistically, and gradually they begin to free themselves a little more and abstract. Henry Moore, the sculptor, I'm sure you all know his works with the whole, the voluptuous curves with the holes in the body and everything, started out realistically and was so wrapped up in what he was doing and with the material, the stone, that he tried to get at the heart of the stone and broke right through. So that's kind of how art works. I wrote down a few things, ideas about sculpturing. Rodin, you know, the thinker, sculptor, said that sculpture is the art of drawing from every angle. And I think that's maybe the most profound definition of sculpture that I've heard. The first thing to look for in a sculpture is not the skillfulness of execution, not the resemblance to corresponding objects in nature, not its usefulness, but rather the thing to look for is the shape of the thing in bulk. That doesn't mean that when you look at a sculpture, it should appear heavy, because the important thing in sculpturing is balance. There are many sculptures that that weigh a fantastic amount that, that they look like you could just push them over with your finger. I think of Brancusi's Bird in Space. I was trying to draw it and I just can't, I can't capture it. All it is a kind of a cone or a cylinder out of bronze shaped about like this. I can't capture the gracefulness of this, but it's about 4.5 feet tall. This was done about 1909. I couldn't find a picture of it, by the way. But it's so graceful, it looks like it's floating. You know, it looks like a bird in space to me. And I would guess that this weighs from 800 to 1,000 pounds. There are many sculptures like this. Let's see. The sculptor must keep the material in mind that he's working with. I don't know how I can explain this best, but maybe if you can, you know, picture these works that I've done in another media, say wood or stone or clay. I can't. I would work with it entirely differently. I just can't conceive of it being in anything but metal. Of course, there are exceptions to this. The Winged Victory of Samothrace really is not compatible. The idea is not compatible with the material used. It's a heavy material, and yet there are these wings going out. And it really isn't compatible, but it's really a magnificent work of art. And more important than fidelity to one's material is fidelity to oneself. I wouldn't express myself as Henry Moore expresses himself. If I did, this would put me in a school, and I don't want to be in a school. I want the work I do to stand on its own. Sculpture relies on unity. There must be completeness in matter as well as thought. Any extraneous material will be distracting, just like anybody that has many nervous mannerisms like I do. It's distracting. And it's the same thing in sculpturing, and this kind of leads into what I do. I like working with metal because I can disregard all the insignificant points. I have to concentrate on total feeling, the totality of it, you know, just express it as simply as possible. And I'll pass these around and just feel them, and maybe you can see this thing. This is your exercise for you.
Didn't let anyone else talk, no.
Any questions?
We told you everything we know.
What did he name those sculptures? I haven't been here long enough to know all the names of your work.
Well, that's Christ with the towel and the bowl of water.
Somebody said it was a dancing Christ. Did you say that word, or was that someone else's word? And then the other pieces you have there.
It's Carol Henderson. This is a flower. This is any kind. This is all made from junk from the mill up here. And this is burning bush.
When you start, Terry, do you build up or do you take a piece and take down from what?
Both. Usually I build up and then start cutting away what I don't want.
Do you know what you want when you begin?
Do you make a sketch first?
Do you have a picture of it in your mind or something?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You sometimes find metal and then sort of see something in it that doesn't lie there, and then you've got
it. Mm-hmm. Like the flower, I haven't done any cutting on that at all. It was all scrap pieces.
And you sort of, as you saw it on the ground or wherever it was, and you see, oh, there's the flower.
Mm-hmm. Well, I saw the petals.
Yeah.
And then I found this big mill ball, which crushed the ore, and that became the center of the flower.
Jerry, I've seen pieces, what they call art, University of Wisconsin, their art museum up there. And as far as they've given it a title or given it a name or something like that, they call it something. But it just looks like somebody has welded a bunch of pieces of metal together. Have you got any criticism of this type of art? Or
yeah, that's improviser. Well, I don't know, you can look at that different ways. It could be a very abstract representation of something. Or it could be an artist that is insincere and is just hinting his audience. I hate to think that there are artists like that, but I'm sure.
Well, they seem retarded. Very bad.
You mean you can't see anything else?
No, I couldn't see a thing.
Any line or movement or.
I don't know. You're out there one night with one of the professors, and you just he seemed to think it was a work of art, and you're supposed to take your own interpretation of it. And but they had it there in the museum, and I just didn't see why he felt it. He didn't really explain it. He was supposed to be able to.
I saw a collection one time that contained some sculpture. And some of the sculpture just consisted of maybe burned out light bulbs or something. And they put two of them together and put it in this pan, and they label it.
Have you ever regarded it as burned out light bulbs or work of art?
No. And well, another one I especially remember was just a pink light that was turned on in a corner.
Pink fluorescent light.
And it was called Pink in the Corner.
We all take for granted the artist is just trying to make us become aware of the beauty of some of the common.
There is one art form that I just don't get, and that's the can of Campbell's tomato soup. Yes, that just really leaves me.
I don't exactly know if it's morbid, but it might be just trying to shock you. He might be trying to take everyday objects and take it out of context and show you that it can look different out of context. You might be saying you wanted something to look like it, and now I'm giving you something to look just like it. And then they don't like it.
But yeah, I've also heard there were some artists that I think were congratulated criticized this collection for just being sloppy craftsmanship. No guy was too lazy to do anything, so that was the impression I had.
I'd say the day inventiveness is far more important than craftsmanship, because no machine can do so much fine tuning. Craftsmanship is way down. They don't feel this is the more important thing in the work.
There was a contemporary sculptor that made a huge hamburger out of paper mache with pickles and ketchup and onions and everything. This was a gigantic hamburger. And it was being shown in the courtyard of the Louvre. And they had to lift it in there with a crane. And the day after they lifted it in there, it rained.
Oh, no.
And it just melt it all.
The one I love is that one that this man made, and then, you know, in the climax of the show, it blew itself up. Now I can see some, you know, even I can see some of that. But that Campbell soup can, I didn't know.
That occurred after World War II, too. They thought life was so ridiculous and so remote and just a gun and such extremes. It was ridiculous. They resented it as nothing. They reacted to it. Everything was ridiculous. And it really had a great philosophy behind it. It's amazing to me. It's reoccurring now with all our wondering what's wrong with the world of war.
It's hard to preach at you.
Well, it can. Doesn't have to, but that can be one part of it. I think today, though, we don't like it because it seems like it's all that. And I think we've got to remember, even if the museums are promoting a certain thing in the school, there are all these other things going on that are also art and tradition.
Yeah, this is one thing, museums and certain people, you know, art buyers and dealers, sort of control the market. Yeah, it's a very, they put out and someone puts a big price on something and someone buys it and all of a sudden they've got a new roof.
Yeah, they can business out.
And, you know, that's where, and even the critics will, you know, they have their friends and their friends. So the individual, you have to have a common vision. The artist is the one who's got the common vision of what he does, but then you're looking at it, can say, it's
decide whether you're
going to
eat or not.
Another thought that came to me, wrap things, wrap packages, wrap stoplights, wrap homes if you could. And I witnessed one object artist who wrapped a plastic balloon full of balloons. It was the size of a house, and it had a helicopter getting it up in the air. Like I stood so for the soul, why from the helicopter? But to me, I can see this out on the outer edges of art. It's kind of out there, but he has the right to see that the rat page and the form and closing the form is another way of presenting form. But I don't say it's the whole thing. I think we recognize it, and it may be an opening up of another entirely new field. Something will come from it. So we can't deny it because it's an idea that something's going to spring from. The raw idea may be pretty raw, for better word.
I think that really in all of the arts we're headed for a renaissance, another renaissance. Within the next 10 or 15 years, maybe don't think that, but I think we are, and we have to kind of recognize some of these new movements.
A few years ago at Chicago, the painting that won the first prize of several thousand dollars, canvas, complete black, with no particular brushstroke, movement, just black. I forget its title. But in a show that size, and I believe the first prize was something like $10,000.
Yeah.
I remember reading about it.
I never could figure it out.
But again, it's the intent of the artist, the idea he has behind it, and that's what they want to do.
I think artists actually don't have a section on painting canvas.
I don't know.
You need to have your own individual way of expressing yourself in your art. Is it difficult when somebody comes up to you and says, I want you to paint me a picture, theory you want, a sculpture, ceramic? Does this all of a sudden do this for this person? I mean, can you really get a deep feeling for it if you're doing it for somebody else on a certain level?
That's the hardest to do. You never get around to the thing. I have done it before, and I said to the person, if you don't like it for painting, tell me, because I'm going to do it my way, and I'll try to put in the ingredients that they suggested. But it would crush me to think someone took something because they were trying to believe me and really didn't like it. If I saw one of my paintings in someone's closet, going to be crushed because I want them to respond to it too. I'd much rather have done a painting and have someone come to it and just say, oh, I respond to it, I like that. But I have done paintings and I've been completely surprised and delighted when the person does respond. But I would consider it no info. If they came and said, gee, I just, that really wasn't what I wanted, and I said, fine, I'll keep it.
Well, some of our greatest paintings are masterpieces. Were painted on order.
But not the decor of the room in which the painting was
done. Well, they had a lot of fights too over whether or not to be accepted like El Dorado.
I'd like to. I think I just did my piece. I'm kind of wondering why, how you artists who probably thought about this account for the offense that your work often has in people today. It, especially because you're talking so much about how things should be responsive and how you're responding to your world, and your response that I see getting that. Usually, I mean, most people here, we have thousands of stories about the odd things that we have seen called objects of art. And it sounds to me like most of us find them repugnant or offensive, especially if they dare to be called modern.
Could this be the unknown again, you know, when we get to know something?
Yeah, but you're more the artist is supposed to be telling us of the time.
Not necessarily. Artists can be ahead of the times, too. Or people have to be brought up to it. But it's there, you're confronted with it. Not everybody is going to reject it. Some people are going to come to it and stand it. Maybe the next time.
So in the more abstract thing, the offense is that we haven't seen it.
Because you forgot to mention maybe, or add to it, that the abstract person is maybe working in the very purest state and prefers to work there, and maybe that doesn't bring the ball.
Heard, it sounds like people consider it very impure. Not nice.
But really, the under basis of almost all works of art, there's some kind of abstract construction, whether it's very obvious or it's left there, or it might be weak.
Of course, the true test, again, of art is time. You know, the great abstract artists today, really, or that we regard as the great, like Pollock and Mondrian, Brancusi, were working, you know, in the early 1900s. So they've already done about 50 years.
Who did Newt descending the staircase?